On this 24th day of July 2006, we are reading from the Srimad Bhagavad Gita as it is, translation and commentary by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. We are still in Chapter 1, observing the armies on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. And I forget the... 44. Text number 44. 144. Probably on page 63. Aho batamahat papam kartum vyavasitavayam yad raja sukalobhena hantum svajanam udyata. Translation: alas, how strange it is that we are preparing to commit greatly sinful acts. Driven by the desire to enjoy royal happiness, we are intent on killing our own kinsmen. Purport. Driven by selfish motives, one may be inclined to such sinful acts as killing of one's own brother, father, or mother. There are many such instances in the history of the world, but Arjuna, being a saintly devotee of the Lord, is always conscious of moral principles and therefore takes care to avoid such activities. Om Ajnanat Marandasya Gyanandana Shalakaya Chakshurun Meditam Mena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. I was born in the darkness of ignorance. My spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. I offer my humble obeisances unto him. So this is the crux of Arjuna's doubt, is that he doesn't want to perform any sin. This is a characteristic of a saintly person, that he's very eager to avoid sinning. In other words, violating the scripture. Boom, just that inner door. Yeah, the inner door. Thank you. That he's very eager to avoid violating the scripture, the scriptural injunctions, and thereby incurring sin. It's explained in the beginning of the Bhakti Samhita Sindhu, and in many places, that suffering is due to sin. Suffering, whatever suffering we are going through in this world, it's due to sin. What is sin? Sin is a violation of the laws of God. Well, how do we know what the laws of God are? By hearing from revealed scripture and those who are transmitting revealed scripture accurately and purely. So, in other words, the guide for a life in this world with the least suffering and the least pain, in other words, a sinless life, is to understand, be in knowledge, first of all, of what proper activity is, what pious activity is, what sinful activity is, and to avoid the latter and try to do only the former. So this is the framework in which Arjuna is speaking now. So he has come to the conclusion, and he has referred to the Vedas. You know, I have heard it said, he says here. I have heard that those whose family lineage and family culture and traditions are destroyed dwell always in hell. And what to speak of those who cause that to happen? You know, if I cause someone to suffer, if I induce someone to perform some sinful activity, but I don't do it myself, I'm also liable. Isn't it? Isn't there there's some, like, suborning perjury? If you induce someone to perform perjury, that's also a crime. So sin is like an infection. It's like an infection. If you get if you associate with people who, number one, are ignorant of what is to be done and what is not to be done, and we can see from chapter 16 that this is one of the prime qualities of the demons. They don't know what is to be done and what is not to be done. Or they don't take it seriously. But one way or another, they end up acting wrongly. So if you associate with people who take it lightly or don't even know, then you're likely to be drawn into that sinful milieu, if you will. And so it's just like an infectious disease. So Arjuna has now this word, aho bata. This is an exclamation of surprise and horror, really, in this context. How strange it is, you know, I, who am, after all, born in a good family, raised properly, am now, you know, wanting to kill my relatives and my teacher and Bhishma, who is revered by all of us, just for the sake of some crummy kingdom? Forget it. You know, he's got his argument here. He's ready to, you know, QED, that he's not going to fight. So, and it all makes sense on the material platform. But we're not on the material platform. This is the whole point of the Bhagavad Gita, and it's completely, you know, rises above that in the next chapter, is that the main factor here is that Dharma personified is sitting on the same chariot with Arjuna, and he wants him to fight. And so as we were hearing this morning in the class, Prabhupada gave class this morning, for those who weren't here, he was explaining that Yudhishthira, for instance, Yudhishthira was known to be Dharma personified. He would never tell a lie. This is one of the things that you know, people who are very religious don't do. They don't tell a lie. So in the heat of the battle, Dronacharya was on the other side. And Dronacharya was the teacher of both the Kurus and the Pandavas in the arts of war, so he was very skilled. And it was understood we wouldn't be able to kill him unless we really got him depressed and his confidence was destroyed. And so he had a son in the battle named Ashwatthama. Ashwatthama then figures in the first canto, those of you who read the first canto. So this son, Ashwatthama, now he was a Brahmin, Dronacharya was a Brahmin, although he knew the art of war and he was the teacher of the Kshatriyas, was also fighting in the battlefield. So Krishna told Yudhishthira to lie and to say and to cry out in the middle of the battle that Ashwatthama is dead. Ashwatthama, the son of Dronacharya, is dead. There's so many fighters that some may have the same name, so you always have to, you know, Ashwatthama, the son of Drona, is dead. And that way, Dronacharya would, seeing Yudhishthira say it, it must be true because he never tells a lie, and therefore he'll become discouraged, and then Arjuna or someone else can kill him. Actually, I think Drishtadyumna was empowered to kill him. So this was Krishna's ploy, inducing someone to tell a lie. Yudhishthira refused. He says, no, I can't tell a lie. I don't do that. So that was a sin. Telling the lies is usually a sin, but because Dharma personified in the form of Krishna ordered him to do it, and he didn't do it, therefore he was sinning. You see the reversal there. And therefore Yudhishthira had to see hell. He didn't actually suffer in hell, but he had to see hell. And that was his punishment. So in a similar way, whatever sin Arjuna has concluded is going to adhere or inhere to his activities here on the battlefield of Kurukshetra is completely nullified because Krishna is ordering him to do it. As he says at the end of this Bhagavad Gita, Sarva Dharmam Parityaja Mami Kamchananam Braja Aham Tvam Sarva Pape Bhyo Mokshi Yasyami Mashuchaha. That you simply give up all other dharmas, all other considerations, such as what you're explaining here in the first chapter, and just surrender to me. In other words, surrender to my order. Do what I say. And I will liberate you from all sinful reaction, if there is any. Basically, whatever previous sins you had committed that might have some residue that are affecting you, that's eradicated. And anything that you think is sinful here is eradicated. It's completely biased. And the whole idea is that you're no longer the doer. You know, you're acting like a hand. If I shoot someone with a gun, I commit a crime. Do they arrest the hand? Is the hand also liable? No. I'm liable. Is it? The hand is just my agent. So similarly, if we become Krishna's agents, then it's all on him. We may not understand how things are going on, how this battle is actually the most pious activity. Just as some people misunderstand how the gopis going to dance with Krishna is the most pious activity. When from a material point of view, it looks like impiety, adultery, it's horrible. You see? But because it's in relation to Krishna, he wants it, it's great service to him, therefore it's piety. So this is the theme here. It's a very important point that is being brought out in the first chapter here, and that is that we cannot really understand what will bring about the greatest good, what the intricacies of Dharma are. We have to hear from a superior authority. And this is the problem today, is that it's an ocean of ignorance. People don't know what's good for them. So they naturally default to the least common denominator, which is what pleases my senses. The good has become what's pleasing to my senses, and maybe my family, a little like that. And that's it, you know. And they have no idea about what the ultimate goal of life is, about what is to be done, what is not to be done. They're helpless in ignorance, misguided. So the Bhagavad Gita is spoken to guide them. That's the purpose of it. Krishna took all the trouble to come down here and speak the Bhagavad Gita and do other things in order to reestablish Dharma and enliven his devotees because he cares. He'll never stop caring. He cares that we're suffering out of ignorance. So it's a very wonderful setup here. Arjuna is representing us. He has his own ideas about what's right and wrong. And then Krishna will disabuse him of that and raise the whole conversation to another level, the spiritual level. So any comments or questions on these points? I think we can finish this chapter today. Maybe we can launch into the next one. Yes? Yes, okay. By Krishna.
All right.
And he refused. Actually, I didn't finish the story. What happened was that that I think it was Yudhishthira. He said, "Well, okay, if you don't want to say Ashwatthama, you know, the son of Drona is dead, then just call out Ashwatthama, the elephant is dead. There's also an elephant that was killed called named Ashwatthama." So he said, "Okay, that's the truth. I'll say it." So he's calling out Ashwatthama, the elephant is dead. But when he was saying the elephant part, Krishna blew his conch shell and he drowned it out. So all that Drona heard was Ashwatthama is dead, and he thought his son was dead. Krishna always has a way of tricking, you see? You understand? So Yudhishthira told the truth, but it came out as something that he didn't intend. You understand? Yeah.
Okay, so whenever he said that we're acting for him, or we're acting, he said we're his agent, something?
Yes.
Okay, and you said that he takes the responsibility for all of that?
Yes, he does.
So in other words, that doesn't mean that we have license to kill, that we have to answer to him, so
In other words, we have to work under the direction of Guru, Sadhu, Shastra, you know. So when we are at, you know, what to do and what not to do, that, you know, is within that compass. In this particular case, Arjuna's guru is Krishna himself, and he's asking him to do something that seems to be sinful, but isn't. I mean, even today, okay, for instance, we have some young boys here, and bhaktas, and some who are not so young, okay? And, you know, part of what it means is, okay, why don't you come and live in the temple? Now, when I came to live in the temple, my parents didn't want me to do that. You know, I wasn't in school at that point, but, you know, they had plans for me and so forth. And what are you doing? You know, like that. So they saw it as a sin. They saw it as a problem, as the worst thing for you. You know, we have all these plans for you, now what's going to happen, da 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 da. But Krishna, we know what Krishna wants. Krishna wants us to surrender. He wants us to perform bhakti yoga. And the best place to do that, to be trained to do that, is in an ashram environment. In other words, it's right there in the shastra. You know, chakvasva dharmam chadanamba. Narada Muni, when he teaches his disciple Vyasadeva, about the importance of writing Bhagavatam, he has some very important instructions. And one is, he says, Chaktva svadharmam chadanam bhajanghare bhajanna pakvota patetato yadi. He says, if someone gives up his duties within society, now, those duties there is talking about varnashram dharma. But basically, you know, whatever duties you have in society, you give them up and you just worship the lotus feet of Hari full time. But, you know, the verse has several levels. You don't complete the course. You bloop, you know, after some time. And you know, you don't then where is there any loss? Because everything you do spiritually isn't the eternal bank account. You start off from that point next life. But if you very nicely perform all your swadharma, you know, your materialistic duties, but there's no Krishna consciousness, you know, you may become a very, you know, famous person in society, or your family really respects you because you, you know, did all the nice things that you're supposed to do. But in the ultimate issue, what did you really gain? Because everything that you did with that is just on a bodily concept. And you go somewhere else, you see? So the idea is that our family, our friends, our society may think we're crazy. They may think we're jumping off a cliff, or that we're ruining our lives. But they're wrong. We have to follow what Krishna says. This is the whole decision we have to make. Are we going to follow what the Shastra says, and the Guru, and the Parampara, and the people who we respect so much, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Prabhupada, or are we going to follow the opinion of ignorant people? You had another comment?
Yes, since 1866 says to surrender and there'll be no sinful reaction, so did your family get over all of that since there'd be no sinful reaction?
Well, my father never quite got over it. Even a few weeks before he passed away, and I had been in the movement already 23 years. Was it 80? It was 87. No, I'm sorry. It was 14. I was in 14 years at that point. And he said, "When are you coming out of that?" You know. So he never quite reconciled to it. My mother, however, you know, I think that you know, there's different psychology. The mother, if the child is happy and healthy, then that's okay, isn't it? Pretty much. I mean, if your child is happy and healthy and he feels good about what he's doing, you don't care if he makes $1 million. But the father is always thinking, oh yeah, you know, I'm going to live through the sun and you know.
It's actually advanced in your mom.
Huh?
Your mom, that was advanced.
Well, she was, yeah. And she, you know, got back to God and got magazine and she always says, Hare Krishna, like that. So, you know, eventually you have to, you know, reconcile whatever your children do. They're out of your hands, you know. But in the, if we want to do the best things for our relatives, those who care about us, those who know us, we should become devotees. That's a fact, yeah.
Maybe he didn't want you to think that he was surrendering to your mission, so he wanted to continue, you know.
I'm not sure what. He had his own conception, you know. Yeah.
We
should never give up learning, you know. Yeah. And that brings us to our next verse. We're going to finish this chapter. And that is text 45. Yadi mam apratikaram ashastram shastrapanayah datarashtra rane hanyusthanme chematoram bhavet. Better for me if the sons of Dhritarashtra, weapons in hand, were to kill me unarmed and unresisting on the battlefield. Purport. It is the custom, according to the Kshatriya fighting principles, that an unarmed and unwilling foe should not be attacked. Arjuna, however, decided that even if attacked by the enemy in such an awkward position, he would not fight. He did not consider how much the other party was bent upon fighting. All these symptoms are due to soft-heartedness, resulting from his being a great devotee of the Lord. So, this is quite a statement. I mean, a kshatriya, you know, a great kshatriya never gives up the fight. A kshatriya means you either die in a battlefield or you are victorious. That's a real kshatriya. And here we see the kshatriya code. You know, if they drop their weapon, then you don't attack. If their back is turned, you don't attack. What to speak if they're running from the battlefield or anything. You know, just compare that to today. I mean, it's just horrendous. They're bombing, you know, children and fleeing, you know, refugees. You know, in America, you know, from the time of Vietnam. I mean, this was why I you know, could not just become a regular person in this society. You know, we're going way back to the 60s when I saw what this country was doing in Vietnam. So this is, I didn't use the word demonic, but that's what I thought. You know, everywhere. There's no sense of honor. It's all, you know, this torture business. I mean, we live in some very evil times. And all of this is going to come down. There's no, you know, it all gets paid for. So the only hope, you know, to set up some kind of moral code, because really much of Krishna consciousness is really like a moral code in one sense. There's so many do's and don'ts, you know, and you're able to follow them when you actually practice Krishna consciousness. But without practicing it, you're just swept away by this hedonistic tide. And hedonism means demonism. It means, you know, what's in it for me? How can I maximize my pleasure, my wealth, my power? And the heck with anyone else. I'll do any horrendous activity. Murder women and children, poison, you know, the ocean. The oceans are being poisoned. They're being, you know, by and fished out. I mean, anyway, it's just anywhere you look, there's some horrific thing going on or just about to happen. So here we have this code, you know, that you just explained here. And if you read the Mahabharata, it's much more elaborately explained. How there was, you know, at the end of the day, Prabhupada pointed out, they would blow the horns, you know. This was one of the conch shells, which we already heard about. You know, blowing those conch shells is a sign that the battle is about to begin. And it's also a sign that the battle should end. It's like, you know, battle, all right, it's like the whistle, you know. All right, everybody, you know, as soon as the game starts, you know, they fight, and then the whistle is blown, okay, everyone stops fighting, you know. So at the end of the day, when the sun would set, they'd blow the conch shells, and then they would go to each other's tents and you know, have a smoothie or whatever it was they were drinking, you know. In other words, they would relax with each other. And probably they would be told, well, that was, you know, that was a great shot, you know, you had. You really fought well today, and it's not, you know. And then next day, they're out, you know, the conch shells blow, the sun comes up, and they're trying to kill each other. So there's a certain code, very strict codes, and it's all part of this idea of dharma. You know, there's also dunner dharma. There's also the right way to fight, and there's the evil way to fight. And now, one interesting thing about this battle of Kurukshetra, and that is, as the battle went on, because it was really one side was very adharmic and evil, and that was the side of Dhritarashtra and Duryodhana. Remember that they tried to kill in a very nefarious way the whole family by burning them to death in that house of lack. And there were other things, poisoning and all these other things. That was, you know, they were dirty fighters from the beginning. So the strictures began to break down as the battle went on. And at the end, this Ashvatthama, this very Ashvatthama, who never really died, he's still alive today, he killed the five sleeping sons of Draupadi, you know, to try to end the dynasty. He says, okay, it looks like the Pandavas are going to get the kingdom, but that'll be the end of the kingdom. That'll be the end of the line, you know. In other words, it's a sign of the corruption of the Brahminical class. He was the son of Dronacharya. Jonah was a Brahmin, although he taught the Kshatriyas. Ashvatthama was a Brahmin, although he was a great Kshatriya. You know, but it turned out he wasn't a great Kshatriya. He was a cheater. So this is another sign of the advent of Kali Yuga. This all takes place just at the beginning of Kali Yuga. So the influence of Kali is starting to show, even on this battlefield of Kurukshetra. Although Dharma will win and Krishna's there, the things are starting to happen. And now it just allows you, you know, a few 5,000 years into Kali Yuga, just see what we're here now. We're practically cannibals, you know, fighting over. It's just unbelievable. So how can we help, you know, and here we are, if, you know, a small society, you know, now we're all over the world, but there's really only a few of us. And the only hope to push this back is by propagating Krishna consciousness. The force of the holy name, the shastra, the devotees who are following, who can be influential on others, and somehow to spread this sense of real religion or dharma in the world, following, as you know, Srila Prabhupada. Okay, we're going to finish this chapter. One more verse. Last verse of the chapter. Sanjaya uvacha evam ukvarjuna sankye Rato pasta upavishat visujja sasharam chapam shoka sambigna manasa. Sanjay said, Arjuna, having thus spoken on the battlefield, cast aside his bow and arrows and sat down on the chariot, his mind overwhelmed with grief. Purport, while observing the situation of his enemy, Arjuna stood up on the chariot, but he was so afflicted with lamentation that he sat down again, setting aside his bow and arrows. Such a kind and soft-hearted person in the devotional service of the Lord is fit to receive self-knowledge. Thus in the Bhaktivedanta purports to the first chapter of the Srimad Bhagavad Gita in the matter of observing the armies on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. So one thing to be observed here is that although, you know, he seems very sure of himself, he's come to this conclusion, he's conflicted. He's totally conflicted. Otherwise, why would he be in grief? You know, he would say, okay, now I've made my decision, off I go, and just leave the battlefield. But clearly he's conflicted because he knows that Krishna wants him to fight and that this is a critical point and that, you know, his brothers, they won't be able to win without him. He's the main warrior. So he's just paralyzed. He's in this, ontological vice, if you will. And in that sense of helplessness, he drops the bow, puts it down, which is a key point. It says in the Mahabharata that he said, anyone who even suggests that I put my bow down, I'm going to shoot him and kill him. In other words, he's an enemy if he tries to trick me to drop the bow. And now he's voluntarily dropping the bow. So, you know, it's a critical point. It's very dramatic. The whole thing is very dramatic. And we continue a little bit into the second chapter here with the same idea. And then Arjuna will surrender and Krishna will begin his instructions in text 11. Okay, any final discussion? Yes?
The last word is self-knowledge.
Yes, it is. Self-knowledge. He is fit to receive self-knowledge. In other words, you know, this is kind of the ideal. You know, when you see in our examples in the Shastra of when devotees actually approach a guru, it's always in a point of confusion. You know, think about Vyasadeva. When he didn't know what to do, he had written the Mahabharata, he had written the Vedas, the Vedanta Sutra, all of this stuff had already been written, but there was something missing. He was he was lacking something. And in that, you know, need, he meditated, and Narada Muni appeared to him and gave him the essential instruction to write the Bhagavad Gita. When Sanatana Goswami surrenders to Lord Chaitanya, he finally escapes from the jailer, with great effort, he takes sannyas. Basically, and then meets Lord Chaitanya, and then he asks him, why am I suffering? Kene am I? Who am I? Why am I suffering? If I don't know this, people call me a great scholar, but I know that I'm just a fool. You know, these basic questions. So, and here, Arjuna's another example, that he comes to the point of just desperation and says, I don't know what's good for me. You know, I'm confused about my duty. Now please tell me for certain how I can get my greatest benefit. I'm a soul surrendered unto you. I'm your shishya or disciple. So that's a critical point. You know, we should also all feel kind of the urgency. Here we are in the human form of life. Time is going by. Every one of us is a day older than we were yesterday. Who can argue? You know, we're all heading toward that critical point of death. And we have a certain number of years, you know, minutes, hours, months, years, in order to find out what is the truth, and to act accordingly, and to become Krishna conscious. So that sense of urgency is the key for the inquiring spirit. And if someone is truly receptive, that famous phrase Prabhupada gave, a submissive oral reception, you know, so many people hear so many things, but are they submissive? Are they receiving the knowledge without the mind putting so much static? No, it can't be that way. I read this, I know this, you know, that doesn't, you know. Surrender? Wait, I don't surrender. You know, I don't surrender to anybody. You know, I got my own way. You know what I mean? In other words, there's so many obstacles that the mind can put in the way of the sound vibration. So we have this word, shushushro. We studied this once when we were doing our verses. Shushushro shadadhana se vasudeva katha ruchi syan mahatseviya vipra punyatirtana shevanat. The word shushushro is very interesting. It comes from the word to hear, naturally. But it also means to serve. So it means to hear with the attitude of a servant. You know? Yes, let it all come in. Let me hear and understand and think about it and then act on the instructions. That's just shushusho attitude. And with that, shushusho shadadhanasya, vasudeva kataru chi, the taste for hearing about Vasudeva, Krishna, comes about by serving the great soul, Syan Mahat Sevaya Vipra Punyatirtana Shevanat, who is himself a tirta, a moving tirta, a place of pilgrimage. In other words, to find that great soul like Srila Prabhupada, whom we can serve, and then from that service, with faith and submissive oral reception, we'll get a real taste for hearing and chanting about Krishna. And that taste is the most valuable thing. You know, that taste to be increased up to the limit of actually what we read in Chaitanya Charitamrita, of the kirtans and, you know, ecstasy and love of God, through hearing. Everything comes through hearing. Hearing and chanting, sound vibration. Yeah.
So are we getting self-knowledge right now?
Right now, hopefully. It's not going in one ear and out the other. If you're in the shoo-shoo-show mood, then you are. Okay, did I read the colophon? Colophon is that little thing at the end. I don't think I did. I should read that. Thus end the Bhaktivedanta purports to the first chapter of the Srimad Bhagavad Gita in the matter of observing the armies on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. Yes, Chris.
When we were at the rainbow, a devotee, he was saying how chapter one is essentially like observing the armies, is observing our attachments. I don't know if that was interesting.
That's an interesting idea.
So, like, in other words, Arjuna is like attached to the bodily conception, to his teachers and friends and family.
Yeah. Like I said, Arjuna represents us. You know, he represents the soul who's entangled, but he's intelligent enough to go to the right source for knowledge. That's the key. If Arjuna actually just left the battlefield at this point and went off on his own, then he'd represent the wayward soul who's still searching. But he doesn't. He sits down in the chariot, and then he approaches his friend and guru, Krishna, and he surrenders to him. And that's the key. So if we're intelligent enough to do that, and you know, basically if we take the Gita in the same mood that Arjuna is, you know, he has some doubts, he has some questions, that's fine, you know, then we'll be successful. Our reading of the Bhagavad Gita will be successful. And we'll come to the right conclusion. All glories to the Prabhupada. Hare, hare, hare.